Good morning, everyone. Meeting will come to order. Clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum. We have the minutes of the last meeting ahead of in front of us. Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes. Any questions, concerns, suggestions for changing the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Before we get to the two items of business we have, reviewing the budget forecast and reviewing the 3M agreement, I want to recognize a visitor we've got today. Julia Munson, would you stand up? Welcome to the... Julia is with her grandfather, Jerry, that I think all of you know. And Julia's visiting the legislature today. Welcome, Julia. With that, Commissioner France, Director Kelly, State Economist Cullum Bakitas, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means, and please present the budget forecast.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. So I'll get started right away with the slide deck. If you go to the first page, you can see that some of our comments and that we're going to be making today. The near-term economic outlook has improved for Minnesota. We now have a $329 million surplus projected for 2018-2019 instead of a $188 million deficit, over $500 million positive improvement, and it includes the legislative spending bill that was signed by the governor on last Monday. We also have some modest positive balances into the next biennium, $251 million for 2021. And the forecast obviously reflects some federal action that we'll be talking about both on the forecast side and both on the spending side. So if you go to the next page, I'm just going to walk you through the high-level numbers first, and then I'll let Professor Kambakidis discuss the economic forecast. You can see on this slide that down at the bottom, the $188 million surplus that we had last November, and now we have a $329 million surplus. Or did I say deficit?
Yeah, you said.
We had $188 million deficit last November. Now we have a $329 million surplus, about a $500 million improvement. You can see from the lines that Professor Kambakidis will talk about the revenue line improving by $353 million, and the Budget Director Kelly will talk about the reduction in spending of $167 million, which is a net number because there are numbers that are going both ways. So if we're okay with that, I'll turn it over to Professor Kambakidis to walk through the forecast.
Welcome, Professor Cullum Bakitas.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I will start by talking a bit about the outlook for the U.S. economy and how that outlook has changed since we last prepared a forecast in November. I will then move to the Minnesota economy and finally to the changes in our revenue forecast. So the first chart, which is the one on the bottom of page 2, compares the current U.S. real GDP forecast by our macroeconomic consulting firm, IHS, to their prior forecast. So the dark bars show IHS's February outlook, the one that informs this forecast, and the light bars show their November 17 outlook. The chart shows, as you heard from the commissioner, that the outlook for U.S. economic growth has improved since the November forecast. The U.S. economic data coming in this winter has been solid. So that's one of the reasons for the improved forecast. Consumer spending and business equipment investment have been strong, and consistent growth in other major economies has strengthened U.S. demand for exports. So we have consistent growth across major economies with no major economy in a recession right now. But in addition to those improved initial conditions, so the improved data coming in since November, earlier this year, IHS incorporated into their baseline outlook stimulus from the Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the TCJA, that was not in their November forecast. The addition of the TCJA has had the effect of modestly improving the near-term U.S. economic outlook. It also sped up expected price and interest rate increases and significantly raised the forecast for federal deficits. In IHS's February outlook, consumer spending and business investment both contribute more to the 2018-2019 real GDP growth relative to November. Those were at least in part due to the addition of the impact from the TCJA. So with the lower tax rates on the corporate side and the individual side, both equipment or business investment and consumer spending were incentivized under those tax cuts, and both of those contribute more to real GDP growth in this outlook. IHS has increased their forecast for 2018 from 2.7% to 2.7% from the 2.5% they had in November. That 2.7% is expected to persist into 2019, and then it drops to 2.1% in 2020 and 1.9% in 21. That deceleration, so from 2.7 down to 2.1, that deceleration is due to slower growth in both consumer spending and business investment, so two of the things that were incentivized by the tax cuts, as the impacts of the TCJA are offset by more aggressive monetary policy. So I said that the impact of the TCJA was to raise GDP growth in the near term, but then you have to look at the whole policy system together, and that the higher growth in the near term also increased expectations for prices, which you would have to assume the Fed would respond to that. And the response is higher interest rates, and so the economy slows down back to around 2%. The next chart, the one at the top of page 3, shows growth in total U.S. real consumer spending. So this is one of the items that increased the real GDP growth outlook in the forecast, especially for 2018. So IHS expects consumer spending to remain the primary contributor to growth in the economy, as it has been throughout this recovery and expansion period, even as the pace of spending eventually slows. So in the short term, consumer spending is well supported by rising employment, disposable income, rising household wealth, but then in addition, it gets this temporary boost from individual tax rate cuts under the TCJA. In this forecast, real consumer spending is expected to grow 2.9% this year compared to 2.5% that they projected in November. The improved forecast continues into 2019 with projected growth at 2.4% relative to 2.2% in November. You'll see the impact of this improvement in our sales tax revenue forecast. To be clear, I show you the consumer spending forecast so that you get the you can see the direction that the sales tax forecast might go, but you can't draw a direct correlation between the percentage changes from the November to February forecast for consumer spending directly to our sales tax forecast, because Minnesota taxes only a portion of total consumption that is measured here. Past 2019, however, IHS does not expect consumers to keep up the pace. They forecast a slowdown in real consumer spending in the years of our planning estimates. Spending growth is forecast to decelerate from 2.4% in 2019 to 2.1% in 2020. And what happens there is that IHS expects consumers to shift their focus from spending to saving. And so in their outlook, the personal saving rate goes up. And so that means that consumer spending slows down. It remains an important driver of GDP, but consumers just don't keep up the pace that they've had throughout this recovery. Turning now to Minnesota's economy, the chart at the bottom of page 3 compares Minnesota's headline unemployment rate to the U.S. unemployment rate. So this is the general unemployment rate that you usually hear about. The dark line is for Minnesota and the light line is for the United States. And as usual, the vertical gray bars indicate the U.S. recessions, so the white space between the gray bars are those recovery and expansion periods. With the U.S. expansion in the second half of its ninth year, so that's a mature expansion as we've been talking about for a while now, Minnesota's steady economic performance and our tight labor market continue. The state is currently adding jobs at the same rate as the nation, even as available workers become scarce. And that steady job growth has kept the unemployment rate low. Our unemployment rate, as you can see from the chart, currently stands between the low points of the prior two recessions. It's almost a percentage point lower than what it was a year ago, and it's a full percentage point below the U.S. It's the lowest that we've seen in about 17 years. So that's one piece of evidence of a tight labor market, is that low unemployment rate. Looking at another aspect of our labor market, we turn to the next chart at the top of page 4. In this one, the height of the gray bars show the number of unemployed people in the state. So these are people who are both out of work or don't have a job but are looking for work. So they're unemployed job seekers. And so this is measured in the numbers of people, and it's the same set of people who were measured for that unemployment rate we saw in the last chart. The dark bars here show the number of job vacancies statewide. So in the height of the gray bars, you can see the peak of unemployment during the recession, so where those gray bars peak out. And then you can see how our steady job growth throughout this expansion have brought those people back into employment and drawn down the number of unemployed workers. The dark bars show that job vacancies statewide have grown to a very high level. The relationship between these two bars, the ratio of unemployed job seekers to the number of job vacancies statewide, that ratio has hovered around 1, so 1.1, 1.2 for the last few years. But now you can see that in the most recent data point, the dark bar rises a little bit above the light bar, and that means that the ratio of unemployed workers to job vacancies is less than 1. It's 0.9, and so we have slightly fewer unemployed job seekers than we have job openings across the state. The large number of open positions improves prospects for job seekers, and better prospects may have contributed to a gradual increase in Minnesota's labor force participation rate, which has ticked up to 70.6%. That's 1.3 percentage points higher than a year ago. It's the second highest among U.S. states, and it's nearly 8 percentage points above the national rate. And the increase is notable because Minnesota already had one of the highest participation rates, and it's occurring as the large baby boomer cohort is retiring. So the changes in the economic forecast that I talked about have helped bring up our forecast for tax revenues, and that brings me to the table at the bottom of page 4. As you heard from the commissioner, general fund revenues for the current biennium are now forecast to be $353 million more than the November forecast. Higher expected individual, sales, corporate, and other tax revenue all contribute to the change. So in addition to the improvement in the near-term economic outlook that I just talked about, this forecast reflects increased state individual income and state corporate tax revenues expected to arise from taxpayer responses to the federal law changes in the TCJA. So this was a very big law change, and individuals, business owners, corporate managers are all trying to figure out how this affects them, and they're trying to adjust to that new federal law. And some of the changes, some of the choices they make will automatically affect Minnesota tax revenues under our current law, so even without any legislative action. And estimates of those impacts are included in our forecast. Some of it shows up in the corporate income tax, and the majority of it shows up, and some of it shows up in the individual income tax. And I'll describe those as I describe the specific tax changes. So looking at the table, the largest dollar amount change in the revenue forecast is in the corporate income tax, which is forecast to generate $131 million more than in this current biennium than we had estimated in November. So there are three things that moved the corporate income tax forecast. One, so far this fiscal year, our net corporate receipts are higher than what we had forecast in November, so that raises the base. Second, IHS's near-term forecast for corporate profits growth is a little bit higher than it was in November. And third, we added in some revenue that is expected to arise from corporations responding to the federal tax change. Specifically, the repatriation provisions in the new federal law, under which corporations are forced to deem repatriated all of their foreign source income, so they have to pay federal tax on that, whether they bring it back to the United States or not, but they're paying tax at a very low rate, a much lower rate than what the corporate rate had been, and even lower than the corporate rate is now. So the foreign source income is deemed repatriated. Some of that money is going to be brought back to the United States. And when that money actually is repatriated, Minnesota, under current law, under our corporate income tax, will pick up some money from that. That change is estimated to add $19 million to corporate revenues in the current biennium. Moving to the sales tax, there's another piece to that repatriation forecast that shows up in the individual income tax that I will talk about. So let me talk about sales tax for a minute. So you saw the improved outlook for consumer spending. Again, we don't have a dollar for dollar or a growth rate percentage point to percentage point relationship here, but the sales tax revenue forecast is also up because growth in consumer and business spending on items that Minnesota does tax is up. Sales tax revenue in the current biennium is now forecast to be $119 million more than what we had in November. And that's due to a higher forecast for taxable sales in both 2018 and 2019. So our taxable sales are expected to grow 1.1 percentage points faster in 2018 and 1.6 percentage points faster in 2019 than what we had assumed in November. Okay, to the individual income tax. So individual income tax receipts in the current biennium are now forecast to be $25 million more than the prior estimate. So that's a relatively small change and smaller than some of you may have been expecting to see. But that's because it's the result of the sum of offsetting effects. Some of those effects raised the forecast relative to what we had in November, and some of them lowered the forecast relative to what we had in November. And on net, we have a $25 million change. So, for example, when we construct the individual income tax forecast, we start with a base year estimate of tax liability, and then we build off of that. Our base year for this forecast is tax year 16. In November, we didn't know what tax year 16 liability was. We had to estimate it. But we now know that tax year 16 liability was lower than what we estimated in November. It's about $68 million. So that automatically takes, naively, that just takes $68 million out of each year of tax liability. So that lowered the forecast relative to November. We also, based on the fact that we had, for the first three quarters of tax year 17, we had low estimated tax payments, which are payments that people make on current year liability, typically if they have non-wage income. We had lower estimated payments than what we had a year prior, so no growth in estimated payments for those three quarters. And so we lowered the forecast for some of the growth in some of the items in non-wage income as a result of that. On the other hand, taxpayer responses to the TCJA are estimated to raise income tax revenue on net relative to our November forecast. So I said there's a flip side or a second piece to that corporate story. So when corporations under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act have to deem repatriated all of their foreign source income and pay tax on it, they can now do what they wish with that money. And we assume that some portion of that money is going to be used to pay off debts, and some portion is going to be used to pay out additional dividends and to do additional share buybacks than what they would have done otherwise. And so when Minnesotans receive some of those additional dividends and some of the additional capital gains from share buybacks, their financial income increases and they will pay income tax on that. And so there's an increase in the income tax for that. Let me conclude by drawing your attention to some of the risks in the forecast. That's the top of page 5. So we talked about these taxpayer responses to federal tax cuts. As I said, this was a big change. Many of us are trying to figure out what our withholding, how much we should be withholding, and should we change change from individual to for professionals to being pass-through entities, and all sorts of other things, other behavior changes that people are making. So uncertainty remains about how people will respond to the changes and the impacts those changes have on both the economy and on state tax revenues. I talked about the fact that in this forecast, inflation rises from what has been previously low levels, and that IHS assumes some action by the Fed. But if inflation rises faster than expected, then the Fed will act more aggressively than expected, and that would slow real GDP growth down relative to what we have in this forecast. And one reason that could happen is that when you enact fiscal stimulus, such as tax cuts in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and the $300 billion federal spending increases in the federal budget agreement, that stimulates economic growth late in the business cycle when the economy is at or near full employment, and that can cause more inflation than what we might have expected here. The current environment of consistent global growth, as I said, is a welcome environment for Minnesota's exporting sectors, including agriculture, mining, and manufacturing. But geopolitical events and U.S. trade policy missteps could threaten that climate and reduce overseas demand for the state's products. And finally, with 16 months remaining in the biennium, we've only seen about 30% of the revenues that we forecast for this biennium, and so even small changes in growth rates for some forms of income can have big changes in the remaining part of this biennium and the next. So I'll pass it on to Budget Director Kelly.
Excuse me, I'm going to take some questions here now, if I can, before we go to the next presenter. Representative Hertaus.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Kalamakidis, for your presentation. Is it fair to say, given that Minnesota's household income is above the national average, that Minnesota's consumer spending would mirror the U.S. Spending, as the chart that you had put out?
Dr. Kalamakidis.
Chairman, representative members of the committee, roughly, but there, if you're talking about not so much about consumer spending as, let me just be careful here. So I don't know if the growth rates would be precisely the same. I can look up what we have in our growth rates for consumer spending for Minnesota, because when you're at relatively high levels, it's hard to grow fast. But in terms of the impact on the sales tax, we only tax some of the items that are consumed and that are included in consumer spending, and then we tax some forms of business spending, and specifically the business spending piece is going to vary significantly across states because it depends on what kinds of industries you have. So,
Representative Hirschfeld.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, well, thank you for that reply, because you kind of knew where I was going, because in your presentation last week I asked the question about this. And, you know, if Minnesota's consumer spending does mirror the national trend, I did a little bit of homework over the weekend, and I dug into the sales revenues by county in terms of the sales tax use. And I do recognize that not all consumer spending is taxable income. But what I did extrapolate from Department of Revenue statistics for 2016 was that, kind of on average, it appears that the revenue, as reported in each of the respective counties, generated about 26% of that amount in sales and use tax. So if I were to extend that to the real consumer spending at the national level, that rate, and I applied it to your sales tax projection, that would be about $1.66 billion of revenue, and then discounting that for the actual taxable amount would suggest, I'm not saying it is, but it would suggest that that number should show an increase of about 25%. And the difference in your estimate is $119 million, which you reported this morning, 1.1% growth. I rounded up to 1.2%. But, you know, please explain where $300 to $400 million seems to be a little light on your sales tax revenue projection, because as I look at it, I would expect that number to be in the $500 million range of growth, given the same amount of spending.
Dr. Kalamakidis.
Mr. Chair, representative members of the committee. So I'm not sure I followed the county receipts numbers, but what I can say is that we constructed our sales tax forecast precisely the same way we always do. And what we do is, so IHS gives us this that overall real consumer spending growth number that I showed you. But they also give us dozens, maybe, I don't know exactly how many, but dozens of different lines of forecasts for specific types of spending. So spending on food away from home, and spending on shoes and cars and all sorts of things. And what we do is we construct from that a proxy sales tax base for Minnesota. So we take all of those different items and the things that are taxed under Minnesota, under Minnesota's law, and we put those together, and we also prorate it for Minnesota's share of total consumer spending nationally. And we look at how that sales tax base grows. And we report every forecast exactly how that base grows, and then that influences our sales tax forecast. So on page 56 of the forecast book, if you have it, at the top we report the growth rates for our Minnesota synthetic sales tax base. And for 2018, we have 4.7% growth annually in the sales tax base, and for 2019, we have 5.3% growth, and those are healthy growth rates for if you look into the years prior. They are also higher than what we had in November. So in November, we had 3.6% in 2018, and now we're at 4.7%. And I mentioned that in my notes also, that our proxy sales tax base grows faster in this outlook than it did before. And then we use that growth in the sales tax base, and we apply the tax appropriate tax rates, and that's where our forecast comes from. But it's precisely the way we always do it.
Okay, members, we do have a lot on our plate today, and I want to get to everyone's questions. So, Representative Hertas, I'll recognize you for one more, and then I got to move on.
Thank you, and thank you, Doctor, for that explanation. You're getting into the weeds, and I like that. But but I do want to just communicate to you that the data that I had data mined from the website over the weekend excluded all of the food and lodging sales tax as well. So I'll be watching the estimates as they come in on a month-by-month basis. I think the actual revenue is going to be much higher. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Kolomakidis, thank you. I just wanted to go back to something you went through real quickly, and that was about you were talking about repatriation of money that, you know, under the Republican tax bill. And so a lot of corporations got what I would consider a huge windfall under that bill. And you mentioned in passing something about the share of that that they may use for buybacks of stock. And I wonder, I just wanted to ask you to kind of quickly revisit that. And the real question I have is, when the corporations are using that extra money now to buy back their stock, what impact, if any, does that have on our economy?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kolomakidis.
Chair, representative, members of the committee, so what is the impact of the share buybacks on the economy? So what that typically does, so it's a corporation has cash, and one of the things they choose to do with it is to buy their own shares, shares of their own company, and that typically increases price of the shares because it increases demand for those shares, so it increases the price. And the people who own those shares then have a higher price. Their shares are more valuable, and they get capital gains from that, higher capital gains from that. And so capital gains in the economy have the effect of improving people's – if they're gains that you have not realized, so you haven't sold the stock yet, just the price went up, then that increases the value of your portfolio. And when individual households have a more valuable portfolio of assets, we have what's called a positive wealth effect, and they tend to spend more. And so that boosts consumer spending, and consumer spending is an element of GDP. And when they sell the shares, they can use that money to buy things also, and that increases our tax through the individual income tax.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, one follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be quick. So from what you explained, so the value of that tends to go then to people who have a piece of the stock market. Mm-hmm. And the many people who don't own any stock are only, if they get any benefit from that, it sounds like, to the degree that the state gets some additional income tax revenue from that, maybe it goes to them that way, but there's no kind of direct more impact through the economy itself on those lower income folks who perhaps don't own any stocks.
Dr. Kolomakidis, did you want to say something to that?
I'll just say that, Mr. Chair, that I think that's correctly characterized. Everybody gets an impact, the indirect impact of increased economic growth through increased consumer spending. But otherwise, yes.
Representative Hornstein.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was interested in your third bullet point on forecast risks, global growth and trade policy. And in light of what we've heard some pronouncements coming from the White House in recent days concerning trade policy, I'm wondering how dependent are we on foreign trade, particularly with Canada, and what are some of your initial takes on some of this more recent, over the last few days, trade war discussion? What impacts could that potentially have on our economy?
Dr. Kolomakidis.
Mr. Chair, representative members of the committee, economists generally like trade because it allows geographic regions to specialize in the thing they're best at, sell that stuff, and then buy stuff from other people, and it makes or other countries, and that makes makes economic growth go better, grow faster, and that's true for Minnesota. It's very good for Minnesota's economy that we have important sectors that export, that have the customers outside of the state and even outside of the country, because that means that the money that those customers spend brings money into Minnesota and makes Minnesotans better off, as opposed to if all the money just circulates within the state. So exporting is important. Bringing that money in is important. As you correctly characterize, we trade very heavily with Canada and Mexico. And so looking at the trade relationships with those countries are critical. And then, of course, our agricultural producers, a lot of those products go outside the country. And so exports are important to those countries or those industries too. What I would say about trade is that it's very trade policy is it's very important to think about trade policy as both sides of the table. So the United States can make a move in trade policy that looks like it's going to help or going to protect. It's called protectionist trade policy. It's going to protect a domestic industry. But you have to assume that the countries on the other side of that are then going to respond. And so you can't look at this as a one-move game. It's a multiple-move game. And so you have to look at what those countries are going to do in response. And that's the main concern about protectionist trade policy, is what are those other countries going to do, and how are those actions going to potentially reduce demand for our exports?
Okay, members, I've got Representative Fabian and Carlson, and I've got a couple of questions that I'm going to cut things off for now in the interest of time so we can keep moving. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, back to the question from Representative Liebling. I'm curious to know if you have any kind of quick information on what percentage of Minnesotans have some sort of retirement account set up, whether it's through a public employee union or it's through their own 401k or their 403bs or whatever. What number of people benefit from potentially a rising stock market?
Dr. Kolomakidis.
Representative, Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to how many Minnesotans have some exposure or some assets in the stock market. But your point is well taken, that a lot of working people have owned shares indirectly through their directly or indirectly through their retirement.
One follow-up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you. And so then what would be the benefit to that money not coming back, not being repatriated? How could we possibly benefit our economy if that money stayed in some account in the Cayman Islands or someplace?
Dr. Kolomakidis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can't think of a benefit to having the corporate foreign source income stay abroad.
Thank you. Make
sure that they get Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, some have indicated that that you weren't optimistic enough, and personally I think you were wise in choosing the baseline, but at the bottom of page 11 you talk about the probability of pessimistic, mm-hmm. optimistic, and then the baseline, and I think that would be helpful for the committee to look at that, or if you could comment on that because of the high probability of using the baseline. And the Council of Economic Advisors spent quite a bit of time, and I think I'm not going to put words in their mouth, but I think they were comfortable with utilizing the baseline almost universally as they went around the table.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Columbakidis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, members of the committee. Yes, so IHS produces for us three different scenarios. They produce a baseline scenario, which is the one that they think is the most likely to occur. And then they produce a pessimistic scenario that has lower economic growth and an optimistic scenario that has higher economic growth. And then they assign subjective probabilities to both of those alternative scenarios. And in this outlook, IHS assigns a 65% probability to their baseline outlook. So that's the one that we used. And that's the one that the Council of Economic Advisors assessed and said that it was a reasonable or a good starting point for Minnesota's economic and revenue forecast. The council was comfortable with the level of growth. You know, often the council is rightly concerned about the out years of growth, but the fact that the growth is modest going into the out years, they were comfortable with. IHS assigns a 20% probability to a more pessimistic scenario that involved a two-quarter recession this year. And then a 15% probability to a more optimistic scenario. And so the baseline, this is a fairly tight probability or fairly high probability for the baseline scenario.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Dr. Columbakidis, then a couple of questions I've got. If I can follow up a little bit with what Representative Carlson was saying. You know, as you look at this forecast, do you feel like you yourself have the same confidence in it as in past forecasts, or less so or more so?
Mr. Chair, that's an interesting question. I do feel comfortable with it. I think it was a good forecast for us to start with. And in particular, I'm comfortable with the fact that the higher growth that they have in the near-term outlook doesn't persist. It would have made me more anxious if they had the higher economic growth continue into the out years, especially when we're in a mature economic expansion. I would have been a little uncomfortable with that. So I'm comfortable with this scenario. I would say that we are operating now in terms of forecast in the U.S. economy. We're operating under a high degree of policy uncertainty, and so that makes things really difficult to forecast, and not, you know, even aside from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and what is that going to do exactly, but there are other policies that are in flux, like trade policy, still immigration policy, how those things are going to affect the economy is uncertain, and so there's still a significant amount of risk. I would say it feels like it's less risky than the November outlook, because in the November outlook we didn't have the tax law in there, and now we do. And so, as the commissioner mentioned in the beginning, there are some questions that have been answered between November and now.
Okay. And then I don't know if this question is to you or to perhaps Commissioner France. You know, compared to the November forecast, if you look at 2018-19 versus 2020-21, you know, we've got $251 million in 2020-21 versus the $329 million. And a big chunk of that is because the stadium reserve goes up from $27 million to $58 million. I guess why is that? That seems, you know, that's a lot more money than we've ever had in the stadium reserve before. You want to take that, Commissioner France?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members. Yeah, what we're seeing is, as we've noticed the last several, I'd say two years at least, we've seen a growth in the stadium reserve fund. And many of you will recall that what we did is we set up a special rainy day fund just for the stadium financing. So the idea of the stadium reserve fund is to be there in the event that we need money to sustain the paying off the debt at the stadium financing authority. So what's happened, though, we've seen charitable gambling incomes or receipts have been going up the last several years, and they continue to project upward. And so the growth that we're seeing in the projected balance of the stadium reserve fund is a realization of projection of continued growth. And also in 2021, we see Minneapolis for the first time, pursuant to the agreement, start paying, I think it's $20 million a year in support of this fund. So there's both a combination of growth in charitable gambling and the addition of $20 million, I think it's 2021, that the city of Minneapolis begins paying into the fund.
And what is our annual payment for the stadium? that this reserve fund backs?
Mr. Chair and members, we estimate it fluctuates somewhere around $50 million. We'd like to maintain at least a balance of about $50 million in this fund in order to sustain at least 1 year's worth of funding for the stadium. It's a little bit under $50 million. I don't know the exact number.
All right. So we have, at this point, we're going to have more than a year's worth of payments in it. All right. Okay. And then, Representative Detmer, do you have a question to that point?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Franz, isn't it true that there's more funds coming in with the charitable gambling because they've been taxed more, their higher rate of tax, and less money is being kept in the local communities for activities in the local communities? Is that why more money is coming in? One of the reasons?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, members, well, the tax rate was set back in 2012, as you recall, as part of the stadium legislation, and that tax rate has not changed since then, as far as I'm aware of. So the growth really is the growth in charitable gambling receipts. Remember, we had, I think, $36.9 million in receipts, tax receipts per year in 2012, and that was established as the base. So any money, any revenue that came in above the $36.9 million per year became part of the stadium reserve fund. So what we're seeing is a growth in both, paper poll tabs and electronic gambling. So it really is an increase in the activity that's generating more revenue.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just a comment.
You know, all right. Yep.
I've been working with the different community activities in my communities and also the charitable gambling, and they have some real big concerns about this issue. Less money is being kept in our communities. Thank you.
And Dr. Kolomakidis, another question I've got is, I understand that compared to the November forecast, the estate tax is up $45.6 million for 18-19, but it's down $58 million in 2021. So can you enlighten us as to why that might be? Did someone with a lot of money pass away, or were expecting that, or what?
Mr. Chair, it's not that.
All right.
It's that the so it's up due to experience, due to history. So the base was up, and then it's lower, I believe, if I remember correctly, due to adjusting for the exclusion,
the exemption,
yeah.
Okay. All right. And then if I can go to page 31 on the forecast, you know, you've got wage income growing by 2.9% instead of 2.5%. You know, but you've had the non-wage income, you've really adjusted downward.
Mm-hmm.
I know you talked about this a little bit, and that's just based on experience. I mean, what do you think is happening that non-wage income is going down? I mean, is this evidence that we've got higher income people fleeing the state, or is there some other explanation for why other income is going up, but non-wage income, which would be capital gains and such, traditionally earned by higher income people, is not keeping up?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's an interesting question, but let me be clear that wage income is going up, it's growing, and non-wage income is also growing at a decent clip in this outlook. It's just that we lowered our forecast for the growth for some forms of non-wage income relative to November. So it isn't declining. It's just some forms of non-wage income are not growing as fast as we had them in November. Some forms are, like interest income, if I remember correctly, grows faster in this outlook. But the reason outlook that non-wage income is growing more slowly in this forecast is consistent with our observations that the tax payments that people make on non-wage income, those estimated tax payments, grew slower than our forecast for the first three quarters of 17, and were lower than they were the year prior. And so that's something that we do not normally see. And so that made us think that there was something going on. What happened at the end of 17 is that we saw a bump in estimated payments. And so higher than expected. But at the end of 17, what happened was people knew that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was passing, that they were likely to lose deductibility of or be limited on their deductibility for state income taxes, and so they accelerated their 2017 full 2017 liability payments into calendar year 17 instead of waiting until April 15th to pay it, because if they paid it on April 15th, they wouldn't be able to deduct it from the federal income tax. And so we saw an acceleration of payments into the end of 2017. So why did we interpret an increase in estimated payments in the last quarter of 17 not as necessarily that's a lot more non-wage income than we had expected? It could have been. There could be more non-wage income than we expected. But why did we interpret it as a shift? Two reasons. One, we know that the same thing happened in other states. So the question, is this something specific to Minnesota, people leaving Minnesota? No, the same phenomenon has occurred in other places. But in addition, the federal government saw low estimated payments throughout 2017, and there was no incentive to accelerate payments at the federal level. And so it's as if the federal government ran the control experiment for us, and so we could look to that and say, well, how come we got this bump at the end of 17 and the feds didn't? Well, the difference is that there was an incentive to accelerate your payments at the state level. And so I don't think this was a uniquely Minnesota experience, and our choices about our growth rates in those forms of non-wage income are consistent with what we've observed.
Well, I think we're all going to be interested to see when the March 10th numbers come out, what February looks like, because, of course, there is the assumption. I do think that there is quite a bit of money that was shifted from when tax payers would normally make their payment back to December and then January in particular, since we're on a cash basis and people that sent something in December 31st would see more money than in the state coffers on in January. But it'll be interesting to see just how we track over the next few months and how much of a shift there really is and you know, how much there maybe wasn't. You know, we have another item of business today, and I guess I don't want to cut you short, Commissioner or Budget Director Kelly, but do you have anything you briefly want to say about the forecast since we have you here?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. Well, thank you for the opportunity to come today. I know you have other items to take care of. One of the things that I just want to leave us all with, and all the leaders talked about this last Wednesday along with the governor, and that is, you know, we saw a $500 million change and over a $500 million change to the positive in 2021, which is a good thing. Minnesota's economy is diverse. It's growing. But these are modest balances that we have. $321 million is a modest balance. $251 million in 2021 is a modest balance. So I think the challenge is for all of us is to figure out what we can do together to make sure we preserve a balance going forward. That would be my comment.
And, Commissioner, say one thing going back to that stadium issue. Is there any limit in the law on how big the stadium reserve fund can be?
Mr. Chair, no.
All right. Thank you. Budget Director Kelly, anything you want to emphasize to us?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just quickly want to point out a couple of things of spending changes. One, that this forecast does assume that or reflects current law at the federal level that CHIP is now fully funded out to 2027. And so we have lowered our general fund MA spending accordingly, and that contributes $225 million of the $167 million savings here. That's on the Health and Human Services line of this table here. The other big change from our November forecast has to do with the all other line of spending, and that reflects $114 million of increased spending for the legislature, the bill the governor signed into law last week, fully funding the legislature. And it also reflects a transfer from the general fund to the Clean Water Fund of $22 million, a provision that was put into law last session to cover some shifts that were made from the general fund to the Clean Water Fund. The other thing I'd like to note is that in the 2021 biennium, we are now seeing structural balance with this forecast, where in November we were not seeing that. So there is good forward progress with this forecast. Revenues are growing at 3.7% compared to spending at 2.2%. We still have significant inflationary pressures on that small structural balance.
Thank you. One last question, then. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the flexibility. And then to any of the testifiers up there, a concern that I have is that right now Minnesota has a four-tier income tax system. As everyone knows, the state and local tax deduction has now been capped at $10,000, and this has the effect of essentially being a fifth income tax tier on Minnesota taxpayers. The efficacy or the whether it was a good idea to put a fourth tier in place or not is a separate matter. At least we can all agree that that money would be staying in Minnesota. With this change, with the $10,000 cap on salt, there's extra cost but no benefit to our state, and I'm concerned that this is providing yet another incentive to for wealthy individuals to migrate. Is my concern justified or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think one of the concerns we have is trying to figure out, let me answer your question directly. It depends on how we restructure our tax bill. I mean, I do feel that the governor is going to make his proposal on March 15th, along with his budget proposal for a tax conformity bill. And eyeballing the chair, David's here in front of me. But I think the key really is to make sure that we preserve the progressive taxation system that we have, and that we preserve the sort of benefits that we've had. I think everyone is concerned about making sure that the federal change doesn't distort or take out of balance what we've tried to achieve in the past, whether, as you mentioned, whether you agree or not, there's been a balance sort of developed. And so we need to watch that balance. I know that's one thing that Commissioner Bowerly, working with the governor, will be trying to figure out. What is that right mix? What do you do? This is an enormous tax bill. There are so many effects, as you know, both individuals and corporations, and there are like 100 different decisions to make along that pathway to conformity. And I think those are issues we'll be talking about, is how do we preserve what we think has worked for Minnesota, and where can we relieve the pressures that this bill, the federal bill, does put on Minnesota?
Dr. Kolomakidis.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add one quick point to your comment about looking at our revenue reports, and I appreciate very much that you follow those, and you'll be looking at the March 10th report. But I would encourage you to look at the May 10th report, because that's where we will see the bulk of payments that come in on April 15th. And so if people accelerated, you know, decided, I'm not going to pay everything on April 15th, I'm going to pay it at the end of 17, that's when we'll see that bump. So our April surprise, one way or another, shows up in that report.
Thank you. Well, Dr. Kolomakidis, Commissioner Franz, Budget Director Kelly, thank you again for coming and presenting another forecast. We appreciate it. All right. The rest of the meeting will be about the 3M settlement. If I could have Assistant Commissioner from the MPCA, Kirk Padelka, come up, and Assistant Commissioner from DNR, Barb Naramore, come forward. Excuse us as we're working on the technical difficulties here.
Yeah, it is.
That's okay.
Paul's like a spring training. I'm working my face off.
Jared, did you notice the color scheme? I guess no.
I know none of the guys here.
Mr. Kennedy, how are you doing? We could just take our oral presentation without the slides.
We're almost there.
All right.
They always say that. It's always a lie.
You get up there and say,
I know, IT. Yeah, I don't work at computers.
He does more analytics.
Well played.
When I was teaching, Mr. Chairman, I always had the advantage. There was some whiz kid in my class when I would have a technology problem.
Well, we got our whiz kid. I mean, well, we're almost ready to bring him forward.
Talking about teenagers and how that younger generation just knows.
Like I said.
I know. Oh, like you said. There you go.
I don't know about you, but it was always a guy
but if you
that
want, if you
struggling
want to
academically could fix the AV.
That's true.
I was the film strip guy.
Why don't we go forward with just, unless you've got it, Mr. Kennedy, why don't we just go forward with a presentation without the slides?
Proximity
yeah.
To the compliance.
Are we ready? All right. Well, commissioners, welcome to the committee. You know, I've had a number of requests to hear a little bit more about this $850 million settlement, and I know I've got a few questions on it, too, to make sure that, you know, the money goes to the people that it needs to go to. And so if you could give us just a brief run-through of the settlement, and then I know that a number of members have some questions about it. Who wants to go first? Okay, Commissioner Kadelka, is that the way I pronounce it?
Correct.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for having us. My name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and our land issues.
And I'm Barb Narramore, Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources.
Welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. I'd just like to start off a little bit about the 3M Natural Resources Damage Settlement to talk about how this allows us to fundamentally change how we deal with PFC's contamination in the East Metropolitan area when it comes to providing clean drinking water. Previously, we had to focus on a band-aid approach. We would get sampling information from the Department of Health showing that someone's well was over the health values, and we would then go in, provide treatment, or standards would change, and we would have to react. So we would be jumping from well advisory to well advisory with some standard changes going along as we go. That's how Superfund works. With this, with natural resources damages, we really have the opportunity to look at this at a long-term, holistic approach and be able to provide these communities with drinking water that's clean and reliable. Just a very brief history of PFCs in the metropolitan area because these dates come back in regards to the settlement, and we could spend much more time on PFCs, but just on a high level, PFCs are a chemical that were developed and produced by 3M in the 1940s. They were used to make products like Scotchgard and Teflon. The thing about PFCs, they're very persistent in the environment. That's one of the factors that make them so troublesome. The other is that they're toxic, and number three is they bioaccumulate in fish, wildlife, and humans. The other term we'll use quite often is the East Metropolitan Area. And we have a fact sheet out, a general fact sheet that kind of shows a map. But just as you visualize, for those that know Washington County, think of the communities of Oakdale, Lake Elmo, West Lakeland, and then Afton, and then south being Woodbury, Cottage Grove, Newport, St. Paul Park, and the Great Cloud Island Township. Those are the communities we're looking at when we talk about the East Metropolitan Area, because we'll be talking about quite a bit. In general, this started in 2002 when 3M informed the state that PFCs was found in their production wells in Cottage Grove. And that started the MPCA's oversight using the Superfund authorities and state law, working with the company to do additional sampling and really learn more about where the waste was disposed of and the concentrations within the groundwater. In 2007, MPCA and 3M agreed to a consent order, and this codified the responsibilities of 3M under Superfund. And that included provisions about safe drinking water and sampling, but also cleaning up the three disposal sites in the Cottage Grove, Woodbury, and Oakdale. The other important date in this discussion is 2010. That's the date the Attorney General filed the natural resources damage lawsuit on behalf of the state and the trustees, which are the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Natural Resources. So through our work back in 2007 and before, a lot of sampling went on, including 1,000 various wells that were sampled for PFCs. But by the beginning of 2016, we kind of had a leveling off spot where we had 100 carbon treatment systems at residents, and they're granular activated carbon systems, just in case I slip into acronyms, GAC, that's what I'll be referring to. And we were keeping an eye on over 200 additional residential wells. These are ones with high levels, but not over the Department of Health's values at this point. But in 16 and 17, we really had a change. Increasing research on PFCs were coming in, and EPA and Department of Health were looking at these and lowered the drinking water health values twice. And this really put in overdrive the work that MPCA and the MPCA and Department of Health had to do. And we sampled another 1,200 wells. We had to issue nearly 600 additional private wells with drinking water advisories because they were over the new health values. All these folks were offered bottled water. And for those private homes, we also then worked with them to provide a home treatment system, a carbon treatment system. And we had 470 of those that have agreed so far to that, and we've had 385 installed.
Mr. Kadelka, if I could interrupt you a second. We're not going to take the remaining roughly 35 to 40 minutes of the committee to just go through all these slides. Could you maybe get away from the past history some, although I think it's important that people knew about the consent agreement with 3M, and just talk a little bit about the settlement that's been agreed on?
Thank you, Chair and committee members. Just real quick, the settlement really dealt with natural resources damages. That's the long-term issue. I kind of highlighted what we were doing previously with Superfund, but the underlying aquifer, the aquatic resources, our habitat, our fisheries were damaged. And this natural resources lawsuit is where the state was working on behalf of Minnesotans to receive dollars to help make, enhance and restore the damage that had been done. And this was not covered under the consent order, and that's what this 2018 settlement addresses. And as we put together the settlement, the legislature has created a framework for natural resources damages and how it's carried out, and we followed that framework as we move forward, not only in the lawsuit, but also the settlement. Overall, the settlement is for $850 million. That's a grant that will come to the state of Minnesota. $720 million of it is immediately available for long-term solutions looking at clean drinking water, but also restoration and enhancement of the natural resources that were damaged in the area. Some other components are in the settlement agreement that are important to note are there restrictions about how the grant can be used. There's a strong expectation for community participation, and it still preserves 3M's obligation under the 2007 consent order, especially around the work that's being done at the three disposal sites and providing short-term drinking water in the future. The first priority that the agreement outlines how the money can be used is, as I mentioned, to ensure clean drinking water to meet the future and current needs of these communities. Again, here are the list of those communities. It's important to note it includes these communities but not limited to, because as we continue to do sampling, we may still find that PFCs are impacting other communities, and this settlement is to help address those communities also. It's not just a snapshot in time. The way this could be done is in a number of ways. One is we could work on larger treatment systems for the communities and hook up homes where there's enough density to municipal systems. Or we could look at alternative drinking water sources, whether that's other aquifers that are not contaminated or the Mississippi River or other surface waters. We'd also be working with those individual homes that are not close enough to municipal hookup so that they would have a carbon treatment system in their house. The other part of this is really repairing the underlying aquifer, and that's going to also be done through water conservation. There is a limited amount of water available in this area, and these communities are looking to grow, and they have been restricted because of the contamination, so we want to address those issues. That includes preserving open spaces to help recharge the underlying aquifer. The second priority deals with the enhancing and restoring natural resources. And this is not only in the East Metropolitan area, but those areas that are downstream of the Mississippi and St. Croix River, because the damage has the potential to move beyond those cities' boundaries. As we look at opportunities here, we'd be thinking about protecting fish and wildlife habitat and increasing access to outdoor recreations that have opportunities that have been restricted because of the contamination. The way the agreement is set up, all 720 is made available right away. The first priority are those clean drinking water systems, but because this is a natural resources damage lawsuit, we also believe it was important that there would be dollars to start immediately to work on the restoration enhancement of those damages at the same time. And that's where you will see the settlement specifically talks about $20 million being available for that. There's not a clear line that X dollars goes to priority one and X dollars go to priority two, but that will be worked on as we create a slate of projects with the communities. There are a couple other expenses mentioned in the agreement. The first is $125 million for the settlement for the outside counsel that helped bring this lawsuit forward and ultimately arrived in the settlement. The next item is $4.5 million about to help with reimbursements from 2017 costs under the 2007 consent order. These are costs that the city of Cottage Grove had to incur because of building temporary buildings for the drinking water treatment systems we had to build. We also have rental of carbon treatment systems for two well locations, and also we need change out of those carbon filtration systems. To just give you the size of these, think of large bulk milk tanks. These are the size of the carbon filtration systems that are being used in Cottage Grove, and we have a number of them that are housed at two locations to make sure that the city of Cottage Grove has water that is that does not exceed the Department of Health's values. The other small expense is $300,000, a little over $300,000 for MPCA and DNR assessments of the damages. This is work that was done early on in the process to be reimbursed. And that's when you hear the $850 million number, and then minus these expenses is where we get to the $720 that is available for those earlier priorities. As I noted, we were very conscious of how the legislature has set up the system for natural resources damages, and I would just like to highlight that you were handed out more details in this slide on the financial framework, including the legislative authority and how this is all set up. But real briefly,
Go ahead, because I've got some questions on that.
But real briefly, any settlements for natural resources under Minnesota Statute 115B.17, Subdivision 7, notes that these dollars must be deposited within the remediation fund. And that's what, when we do get the $850 from 3M, that's where we will deposit those dollars. The funds can be have been statutory appropriated to the agencies to carry out the work, and those authorities are under 116.155, Subdivision 2, In 115D.20, under subdivision 2, paragraphs 2 and 4, and this allows for the agency to access these dollars for these restricted uses to be able to carry out the projects that are noted in the settlement agreement.
Well, Commissioner Kadelka, I want to ask a little bit about that because I want to make sure that this money does, in fact, get to the people that need it and is spent for the purposes that it should be spent. Now, I've got a copy of the settlement agreement here, and it says on the very first page that the money is going to be deposited into something called the, quote, 3M Grant for Water Quality and Sustainability Fund. Now, I don't believe any such fund exists or has been established by the legislature, and I'm wondering if that's something that we then need to set up in order to facilitate this agreement that was made. And I guess I'd like to ask our nonpartisan research, either Mr. Sullivan or Mr. Marks, you know, is, first of all, I guess, is there such a account in existence, and if there isn't, can this money be spent since the settlement agreement says it has to go into this particular account? Mr. Marks?
Mr. Chair, members, there's currently no such account in the accounting system, or account by that name. And I think the discussion of this has evolved over the time period since the settlement was released, and that what is being proposed in these documents is a dedicated appropriation within the remediation fund, which is sort of like creating an account, but not exactly an account, and not an account in the way we would think of accounts, such as there is also the dry cleaner account within the remediation fund. That dry cleaner account's established in statute and has its own statutory appropriation on it. Being kept within what's defined in statute as the general portion of the remediation fund and is defined in the materials that we've received today as the 3M Water Quality and Sustainability Dedicated Appropriation, rather than using the terminology dedicated appropriation rather than account.
Well, Mr. Marks, I mean, does an agency have authority under law to set up a new fund?
Mr. Chair and members, an agency doesn't. The Commissioner of MMB has some general authority to kind of organize the state's funds and accounts. Doesn't specifically say creating a funds or a new fund or account, but that is that's practically what's done under that authority in law.
Okay, but there is no 3M grant for Water Quality Sustainability Fund in existence, you say. I mean, I guess would you say, is there a question as to, in your view, under the law, whether money that's been gotten from 3M under this could be spent legally through this fund?
Mr. Chair, members, if the money is in the general portion of the remediation fund, there is a statutory appropriation for it. If it is in a separate account within the remediation fund, I don't think there is currently appropriation authority. I think it would have to be appropriated.
And the settlement says that the money is going into the 3M grant for Water Quality and Sustainability Fund, which currently doesn't exist, correct?
Mr. Chair, it doesn't exist in current law or in the accounting system currently.
So, Commissioner Kadelka, I guess, given all that, I mean, how can we assure these people that are going to be helped by this money being spent that you actually have authority to spend this money?
Mr. Chair and committee members, as Mr. Marks outlined, the agencies have the statutory authority given by the legislature to use dollars from the remediation fund to spend on projects like this. We believe, working with the MPCA, DNR, MMB, and the AG's office, we do have those authorities. The paragraph 13 that you're referring to is a name of something, and we have named our appropriations in that way, and so we do believe there is the authority. I know on our back of our fact sheet we have an outline of exactly how the money would flow, and we intend to set up the appropriations as noted for tracking. So as soon as the $850 is deposited with the state, there will be a clear pathway that everyone can see how the dollars are used.
Well, I guess, Commissioner, I'm concerned about this because you have a specific fund. In fact, it's enclosed in quotations. That's named on the very front page of the settlement. It doesn't exist. You're saying the money needs to be spent out of that fund. You don't have legal authority to create that fund. I guess and it may be something that perhaps there is some gray areas here that could be argued, but there is an awful lot depending on this money being spent. And, you know, I guess I just wonder if maybe we don't need to look at doing something this session to create this fund and help facilitate it and make sure that there isn't any doubt about the ability to get this money to the people that it needs to get to. Because at least to me, it certainly seems to be a gray area at the least. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To both of the testifiers, on the flowchart that you mentioned, kind of in the center under the $850 million, below that it says approximately $4.5 million transfer, and then there's a $300,000 transfer. And both of those have to do with reimbursing DNR and MPCA. I'm curious to know what are the expenses that DNR and MPCA has incurred that would require reimbursement.
Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'll take the first piece there, the $4.5 million. These are activities that MPCA carried out under the 2007 consent order, and they included working with the city of Cottage Grove to provide those granular activated carbon systems for their temporary drinking water system. It includes the cost that we incurred for changing out the carbon there. There is sampling of private wells. We installed a number of treatment systems in private homes. Those are all the costs that we're looking at here. In addition, about $2 million of these dollars will be going to the city of Cottage Grove. They put a lot of money up front to help build the housing for these systems, and it is to reimburse it to them. Recently, we have signed a joint powers agreement with the city to allow for that money to be reimbursed. So those are activities that we have incurred expenses already in those categories.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, Commissioner Kadelka, I fully understand and support reimbursing the costs of things that you've purchased and have given to the cities. What I'm concerned about, members, all throughout the agreement, is it appears to me that there is a great deal of latitude for the agencies to be able to charge for their administrative costs back against this fund. Is that correct? And including, did you have administrative costs in the 4.5 and the $300,000?
Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the 4.5, there were some costs that were outlined in the agreement that 3M agreed to in the 2007 consent order. Moving forward in terms of administrative costs, we have been focusing right now on setting up a financial system, working on communications. We have not worked on yet what the administrative needs to carry out this are. We have been focusing more on having those initial conversations with the communities. While there will be some need for resources for that, our intent is to make sure that it is as small as possible to carry out the activities as we work together with the local units of government to implement the agreement.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, members, as I expressed in our Environment Committee hearing that we had on this, my number one concern is that the dollars that are being put into this fund are dollars that actually get out to projects on the ground in that area. I have some significant concerns about administrative costs being charged back to the fund by the state agencies, and we need to make sure that we set up some guardrails around this money so that the money is going to be used as it was intended to upgrade water treatment and all those other sorts of things, and to allow for the agencies to be able to charge back for administrative costs to me is unacceptable, especially in light of, and I'm sure that the testifiers would agree that we had a budget last spring that fully funded the agencies. Is that not true?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the budget that was passed last year, there are a number of Superfund projects that have costs across the state that need to be carried out by the state. If the state agencies were not allowed to use any portion of these dollars for the activities of implementing the agreement, we would have to we would be put in a situation where other uses of the remediation fund would have to be diminished as a result to cover those costs. So we want to make sure that there is that balance to allow for other important projects, cleanup sites across the state are carried out along with this important work. Our first priority, too, is to get these dollars into the communities to carry out the work that's needed.
All right. Do you have something else, Representative Fabian? Because I've got a bunch of people that want to ask questions.
Well, just real quickly, I'm still extremely concerned. I'm not sure that I appreciate the answer necessarily, but we need to make sure that we keep a close eye on this and we get this done right so that the people out in the East Metro get the stuff that they need. I'm also concerned about when is this project done? Because Commissioner Kudelka just said, well, we could use this money for other projects around the state. I find that unacceptable. Thank you.
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, just to clarify, these dollars cannot be used for other projects outside of state. I was referring to the remediation fund, that if we had to use dollars from that fund that is going towards other projects to carry out this agreement, we would be using money on those projects, just to clarify. Thank you.
Well, Commissioner, though, if I look at page 4 of the settlement agreement, item C, it says, as the third highest priority, if any portion of the grant remains after the DNR and MPCA have reasonably achieved their goals, the MPCA and or the DNR shall utilize the grant to fund residual statewide water resources, habitat restoration, open space preservation, recreation improvements, and other sustainability projects. It looks to me like you have authority to spend money around the state.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Commissioner Normore.
Yes, thank you. I was actually going to see if I could offer that same clarification. I think Assistant Commissioner Kudelka was referring or trying to avoid any confusion with his reference to the other projects under the remediation fund. But you absolutely correctly point out that under the terms of the settlement agreement, the first priority is the drinking water and groundwater sustainability piece in the East Metro. The second priority, the other natural resource damages within the East Metro. That third tier priority that you just referenced is essentially we needed to have in the settlement agreement a way to wind this down and dispose appropriately of any remaining funds should everything reasonably be achieved under priorities 1 and 2. And so the agreement among the parties was that the most appropriate use of those funds would be for similar kinds of work elsewhere in the state.
All right. Representative Ogenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two quick questions. One of the ways that we can measure what's happening to the natural resource in this area is to look at what's happening to the fish. So we have good baseline data that showed back in the early 2000s that fish in this area had more PFCs than any place else in the world. Do you have data now that you can show us about how fish are doing, and will you be providing that data as we go along so we know what is happening?
Commissioner Merrimore.
Mr. Chair, Representative Guineas, I do not have those data today, but, yes, we are continuing to collect fish contamination data in the area, and we'll make that publicly available.
Thank you.
And Representative Guineas.
Thank you. Having it publicly available is the important part. Thank you. When you talk to us in the Environment Committee, you said that 3M is doing some cleanup of water now and putting the PFCs that they are cleaning up into a lined landfill. You did not tell us which lined landfill that was.
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, After the consent agreement in 2007, there were three disposal sites that were dug up the materials and was brought to a landfill, SKD landfill, in Rosemont. We are working on additional documentation for that question that we have that we'll provide to the full committee that explains more on the design of the landfill and everything else to, as requested in committee. We're just pulling that data together for you.
Representative Guinness. Thank you. The reason I bring this up is we're now disposing of a hazardous waste in a non-hazardous waste landfill in Minnesota. And I'm sure this is a lined landfill, but we have no history to know what happens after many years. This is an experiment. Lined landfills are an experiment. We hope they work. But how long is that plastic going to last? We don't know. So it troubles me greatly that we are not putting this waste into a hazardous waste landfill where it seems that that's where it belongs. I mean, that's future liability. Let's look out for, let's not have this repeat.
And Commissioner Kadelka or Commissioner Naramore, I guess, are you satisfied with the safety of the landfill that will be hold, or the landfills that are holding this, that they will be safe, to Representative Wagenius's question?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we are. This was the material that was dug up in a number of years ago. There's not any new excavation that's being done. This is a isolated cell within a larger SKD complex that's designed to hazardous waste specifications, although it is not technically a hazardous waste landfill.
Representative Guinness.
What about the waste that now is being created as 3M is cleaning up water? Where is that going?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, 3M has a number of pump and treat sites around its disposals, and those are then cleaned up at their facility, production facility, and used in their processes.
I don't understand what that means.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and committee members, they use a number, a large amount of water for their systems, and so it is cleaned up and then used throughout the system where they need water, whether it's, I'm not familiar enough with 3M systems to explain exactly what systems they're using it in, but it is cleaned up and then used so that we don't have to pump out additional clean groundwater for their systems.
Okay, yeah, one last question, Representative Guinness.
That was not my question. I'm not worried about the water. I'm worried about what they are taking out of the water. Where is that going?
Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the filters in that would have to be handled in an appropriate manner. We can get back to you on exactly where 3M takes those materials.
We do need to know that.
Okay. Members, we're going up to 12 o'clock or getting closer to that. I do think there's quite a few members that have questions here, so I'm going to probably extend us to maybe 12:15, just so you know. I think people still have time to grab a bite to eat between their next committee meeting if they need to. I've got Representatives Garofalo, Torkelson, Draskowski, and Hillstrom. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the testifiers, just to clarify, what statutory authorization will you be seeking this session to expend these funds and use them?
Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the legislature has provided the agency ability for statutory appropriations already to use these funds as we do other cleanup sites.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Garofalo.
Originally, to the testifiers, the lawsuit was from the amount of $5 billion. In the event that this settlement was $5 billion, would you have that same view?
Commissioner Kadelka, or yes, Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the framework we're using is the one that has been set up by the legislature. We have smaller projects that come in and are utilized in this manner. If there were larger settlements, they would be utilized in a similar manner as defined by the legislature.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and I think obviously, there's concerns on both sides of the aisle with this view of what current statute is. This is not about PFCs. It's not about cleaning up pollution. This is about who decides and who makes decisions with public money. And I respect the fact that agencies and executive branches of both parties want to circumvent the legislature, but I don't want to speak for my friends on the other side of the aisle, but obviously that sort of strategy and tactic, there's nothing new about it, but this view is problematic.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question relates to the relationship between this settlement and the consent order spending that's going on. I understand the consent order work will continue. Does this settlement replace any of that work? And if in the future we satisfy the first priority of this settlement, will that also satisfy any spending, additional spending needed through the consent order process?
Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, a very good question. So the consent order has a number of key components, and I'll start with the three 3M disposal sites we talked about earlier. They're doing pump and treat there. Under the agreement that was signed earlier last month, those costs are still covered by 3M under the 2007 consent order, those remedial costs. The agreement talks about how it works in conjunction in terms of providing alternative drinking water, safe drinking water. And the agreement talks about for a period of 5 years, up to $40 million, that would continue to come under the consent order for temporary drinking water systems. And when we refer to that, we're referring to, for instance, the city of Cottage Grove, where they have a temporary system on the municipality. Those would continue to be covered under the consent order. The other situation is a private well owner that may have a system installed in their home that would be allowed to continue. Those costs, if we are eventually going to hook them up to a municipality, would be covered under the consent order. The reason it's structured in this way is we wanted to maximize the dollars coming back through the grant and the agreement to have as much possible for the long-term solutions in this area. What we didn't want to happen are some of these short-term costs slowly whittling away at the funds and the dollars and not allow for us to do those larger projects that we needed to do. So that's how it works in the near term. When the grant is expended fully, the consent order stays in place, and 3M then has still those responsibilities to carry on short-term and long-term as needed.
Representative Torkelson.
So even if the first priority of the consent order is fulfilled, there will still be a need for, even if the first priority of the settlement is fulfilled, will there still be a need for ongoing spending as a result of the consent order?
Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, yes. Specifically for the remediation at the three sites, those are not covered at all by the agreements. After the agreement and the grant dollars are gone, if there are other things that come up, we find a new well that may need work taken care of, those would still be the responsibility of the company, 3M.
Well, so I guess, Commissioner, to that question, so then you have three priorities in the settlement here. And you've got $720 million to spend. Let's say that you satisfy priority one and building new treatment plants and such, and you satisfy priority two in the other things that are listed in the settlement agreement. Let's say you've got $100 million left over, which I understand can be spent around the state on all sorts of other projects that necessarily don't have anything to do with PFCs. You're saying that 3M will still be required to be paying out money on the consent agreement, even though you've got, let's say, $100 million that you're spending elsewhere around the state on other things. Is that true?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we do not know yet after we do the long-term projects for Priority 1 and that need is met, or Priority 2, what dollars will be available. Some of those dollars may be set aside for some of the long-term operations or future needs of these projects. Sites where they may need to be there and kept for the local communities before there's the ability to use it on a statewide basis.
Okay, I guess Commissioner Kadelka, my question is, Priority 1 and Priority 2 are funds that are specifically meant to address people in this plume area in the East Metro. And 3M, underneath the consent order, is also spending other money besides this right now to deal with this East Metro problem. I guess my question is, once the agencies decide, if they decide, that all the issues in Priority 1 and Priority 2 have been dealt with and they're going to start spending money around the state, is 3M's liability under the consent order over if they reach that point?
Mr. Chair and committee members, the consent order and the agreement notes that we will periodically review the consent order, but there are a number of activities that are under the consent order that are not eligible at all under the agreement, such as remediation of those three disposal sites. So that will have to continue on, and that is something 3M has agreed to.
So it's your view, Commissioner, that even we have, say, $620 million of the $720 million spent to help the people in the East Metro, and we have $100 million left over, that even if we're spending, let's say, $100 million around the state on things that don't have anything to do with PFCs, because there weren't any PFCs produced elsewhere in the state, it's your opinion that even if we're spending $100 million of 3M's money elsewhere around the state, that they're still required under the consent order to keep spending money?
Mr. Chair and committee members, for those drinking water systems and that, if there are needs a decade down the line and there are still dollars available in the grant, those dollars would be used before that under the consent order. So in that situation, there would not be two folks paying for drinking water. The remedial sites and the cleanup of those three disposal sites are very different from the agreement and other activities.
So you're saying that even if you're spending money around the state and you believe that all of the East Metro needs have been satisfied under the consent agreement, that 3M will still be required to spend other money underneath, excuse me, let me rephrase that. You're saying that even if you reach the point that you have satisfied priorities 1 and 2 under the settlement agreement and you've got money left over to spend around the state, that 3M will still need to keep spending money under the consent agreement?
Mr. Chair and committee members, the 3M has agreed to continue to work on the remedial sites outside of the purview of the settlement agreement. So those are dollars that will still have to be spent by them that they have agreed to continue to move forward. The aspects of on clean drinking water, the fund will be available to until expended.
Representative Drazkowski, Hillstrom, Fabian, and Carlson. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kudelka, Article 11, Section 1 of the State Constitution says, money paid from state treasury. No money shall be paid out of the treasury of this state except in pursuance of an appropriation by law. Which bill from a past session of this body included the language that gave the agency the authority to appropriate this money? I can't really see that anybody here would have anticipated $850 million being available, and this agreement and order came out on February 20th of 2018. The last legislature adjourned in May of 2017. So which legislature provided you the appropriation authority for this $850 million?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Minnesota Statute 116.155, Subdivision 2, notes there, the money in the general portion of the remediation fund is appropriated to the agency and commissioners for the following purposes. I don't know exactly which of the legislatures that had passed that piece, but that is a state law that was passed by the legislature allowing for the agencies to appropriate dollars within the remediation fund on the restricted causes.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Drazkowski.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Kudelka, the agency is reading that to mean that any money that the agency comes upon that they've got authority to spend. That's what it sounds like to me. We've heard staff say there's not even an account created by the legislature for this money, not to mention the fact that the legislature couldn't anticipate the money coming in the first place. Your interpretation then, Mr. Kudelka, is the agency, any money you come upon, you've got the authority to spend. Is that how you're interpreting that law?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the term any money is incorrect. It's talking about specifically revenues that are deposited in within the remediation fund, and only select revenues are deposited in there through the system set up by the legislature.
Last question. Or
I'm out of questions. I'm out of questions, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I think we need to take a much deeper exploration of this. This doesn't seem to be consistent with our Constitution, and as staff has pointed out, we don't even have an account in place for this. I can't see how the legislature anticipated $850 million coming into this account. We obviously did not provide appropriation authority. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me start by making it clear that the court retains authority over this settlement. And if the legislature interferes with a court's authority and its order, we would be violating a court order, and I would assume either side could bring that back to court, and 3M could take Minnesota back. I also want to make it very clear that it was a $5 billion lawsuit when it started, and so the idea that we're going to have all this leftover money is probably not very accurate, and that is why there is language in this agreement that says in the event it doesn't cover all the clean drinking water that's needed, 3M agrees to pay whatever it takes to get these people clean drinking water. So it could be more if the problem is more.
Yeah.
And they agreed to that, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and I guess that's what I was trying to establish, Representative Hillstrom, is certainly if all of the money is spent on priorities one and two and there are additional needs, I can understand 3M being on the hook to pay more. It just seemed odd to me that the commissioner would say that 3M is still on the hook after they have met, if they meet, all of priority one and two. That's what I guess was puzzling to me.
Well, Mr. Chair, there's two different orders. There's a consent order, which
right.
was done back in 2007, and there is a lawsuit agreement. And the agreement says we're not going to relieve you of your commitments back in 2007. And 3M didn't ask to be relieved of its commitment that it made in 2007. Ultimately, the goal is to get people clean drinking water. And 3M agreed that if it costs more than the $890 million to give people clean drinking water, that they know they're on the hook to pay the rest. Now, this legislature has an obligation to follow the agreement by the court, or they can go back to court. 3M can go back to court. State of Minnesota can go back to court. They can nullify the agreement. They can let 3M off the hook to pay for what they did when 3M has acknowledged that they should be on the hook to clean up people's drinking water. This was a significant lawsuit over 7 years. And the state of Minnesota and 3M reached an agreement that is mutually agreeable to clean up the mess that was left. Now, I hope it's enough money to clean up the mess, and I hope that there's money left over to do some things. But PFCs are now even in the at the polls. You're seeing them in polar bears, and this is not a chemical that gets to go away. It's not going to break down over time. It is a forever chemical. So if we find out in 20 years that, in fact, more people have cancer or more people have lose babies or there's more defects, you do not want to tie the hands of the state of Minnesota. And 3M agreed to keep the consent order in place and agreed to the settlement, and I think we should give people clean drinking water. I think that that's a minimum of what we should do here, Mr. Chair.
Well, and I do too, Representative Hillstrom. I guess I'm just trying to make sure that we do, and I guess I have concerns about myself whether this was structured correctly to be able to get the money to the people. And I guess, I find it puzzling when priorities one and two are all about getting clean water to people, that if we reach the point that supposedly we've done all that underneath the settlement, it just seems puzzling to me that then 3M would still be on the hook to be paying money when we're spending other money all around the state on other things other than PFCs. Now, 3M made the agreement to do this settlement. I guess that was their choice, but I'm just trying to understand, A, the authority to that is being claimed here and making sure that the money can, in fact, be spent where they say it's going to be spent, and B, trying to understand this other money that might be spent all over the state on all sorts of other things when and if the agency deems the problem to be taken care of.
Well, and, Mr. Chair, if 3M has a concern about that, the court retains jurisdiction. And I am confident after 7 years of litigation, if 3M had any concern, they would have the opportunity to go back before the judge, and they would.
Okay. Representative Fabian.
Well, just real quickly, Mr. Chair, thank you. There seems to be a number of kind of unanswered questions floating around. Maybe they're not unanswered in Representative Hillstrom's mind, but in mine, it would have been nice if
if you would have invited the AG to be here to help us out.
Representative Fabian, we did invite the AG to be here to help us out, and they did not come. Representative Carlson.
Representative Hillstrom covered the question that I was going to ask about the role of the court. Thank you.
Representative Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I share Representative Fabian's concerns that this $720 million that we have left isn't consumed by bureaucracy and that it actually goes out and helps the people on the East Metro that have been impacted by this. And so to that end, I'm just curious as to why we are paying a law firm $125 million for 7 years of work, because when I calculated that out, that's this law firm, it's a private law firm, they're getting $17 million per year. And if you did that by 365 days, they were earning over $48,000 per day in legal fees for representing the state, even though we have 200 and some attorneys in the AG's office. And I guess, to me, you know, I think most people are probably surprised that $125 million out of the $850 million settlement would be going to this private law firm rather than, one, the state representing itself with the AG and the attorneys that we have there, and then, two, just the amount, the sheer volume of dollars that are going to this private CPA firm doesn't even reside here, I don't think, in Minnesota. I'm not an attorney, but, you know, hourly rates, I know, are can be high as much as $400, but $48,000 per day in legal fees, that seems a little steep. Can you tell me a little bit about how this firm was selected? Can you give us the details on the billing hours, all of that, how that was calculated? And I'd like to see the contract that the state entered into to hire this firm in particular and all the decisions behind hiring them in the first place. Because as I see it, this is just taking money away from the people in the East Metro to address this water problem.
Commissioner Kadelka or Commissioner Naramore, I know you're not with the Attorney General's office, so I, you know, understand that you're not, but I guess, can you take a stab at, I guess I, you know, frankly, I mean, I wonder about the same questions that Representative Anderson's talking about, because, I mean, if we represented ourselves in, we'd have, you know, maybe a hundred some million more that we could be putting toward the environment here. Representative Anderson.
I asked the question because they have it as part of their slide presentation, so it was page 4.
You're asking the question. I've got the same question. So commissioners, who wants to answer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, members of the committee, I can provide some general information, and then perhaps there might be some additional information we can provide in follow-up. At the highest level, what I can say is that the Attorney General entered into the agreement with the Covington Law Firm in 2010 to represent the state in this matter. What was behind that determination to go with outside counsel versus pursue the matter with the state's, the Attorney General's office's own attorneys, I simply can't speak to. What I can say is that this agreement was for representation on a contingency basis. So rather than the state being liable for all of the hourly rates and direct expenses, regardless of the outcome of litigation or settlement negotiations, instead, the agreement that the Attorney General entered into with the Covington firm was, again, on a contingency basis so that they did not would not have received any funding or any money reimbursement from the state had there not been a recovery in the matter. As to whether the amount is consistent in general with contingency cases, for natural resource damages or other types of environmental cases, I'm really not in a position to offer a judgment on that. I can say it amounts to about 15% of the total of the settlement agreement.
Representative Anderson?
Well, Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it would be helpful for the legislative body to, and I realize you guys are not the people that could provide that, but I assume that the AG's office is paying attention to this committee hearing. And I think it would just be helpful for us to have that information because, like I said before, I'm concerned that this is taking such a big ding out of the money that's meant for the people in treating the drinking water in the East Metro area. And I just think overall, you know, I don't think that this should be the route that the state pursues in the future because I see this as a huge detriment to Minnesotans of the state. So,
and again, you know, to that point, Representative Anderson, I have to say, again, I am surprised that on a issue of this magnitude when we as the Committee on Ways and Means ask for a representative from the Attorney General to come and be able to testify on this that they refuse to come. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've actually paid a lot of attention to this suit, and I wanted folks to know that there were over 27 million pages of documents that were part of the discovery process. There were over 200 witness depositions, $10 million in tests, fees, and costs, and over 100 judicial hearings and conferences over the 7 years. And there was 1,600 court filings, and then the final nonstop negotiation lasted over 22 hours. So that is about the scope of just a small snapshot of what this case involved as I've been watching it over the last 7 years.
Okay. Well, members, we are past time to adjourn. I want to thank both commissioners for coming. I think this is a very important issue. I guess I wonder if we're not going to have to pass some legislation to make sure we get the money to the right people here that have been hurt, but we'll be considering that further. With that, members, thank you again. Commissioners, thank you. We are